news outlets with agendas in line with the senator's. This was the first network to air it. With his rifle still shouldered, Reese then turned to the front passenger window of the van and shot the driver through the glass, quickly stepping forward to shoot again.
"Security round," Sawyer said, sipping his drink. Thwaite grunted.
The ghost then walked to his first victim and shot him in the head. The screen then transitioned to video of a man who was clearly James Reese talking to a police officer and firefighter.
"This footage was obtained by Fox Illinois affiliate 32 News and depicts James Reese in Chicago at the home of Kareem Talib. Talib was a Muslim man who died of a heart attack while James Reese was at the scene. It is worth noting that it is common for serial killers to visit the scenes of their crimes and oftentimes keep mementos from their kills."
The screen then switched to local news footage of police tape in a hallway of what looked to be a garden variety roadside hotel. The correspondent on scene reporting on the tragic death of Sohrab Behzad, a Muslim American man working at a local Atlanta mosque.
"We have new evidence tonight that puts James Reese on site at the time of the murder, along with statements from a woman who has verified that Commander Reese murdered Behzad before kidnapping her at gunpoint. She later escaped as he was driving her to a remote location."
The screen then ran a video of a man pushing a woman down a hotel hallway, a gun clearly visible in his hand. They then displayed a photo of Reese in his dress blues, clean-shaven, rows of medals on the chest of his flawless uniform.
"There are still unanswered questions tonight surrounding why Commander Reese would so deliberately target and kill these Muslim American men after meeting privately with the president at Camp David. The only connection between the deceased is that they are all devout Muslims of Middle Eastern descent. Commander Reese's behavior indicates a pattern of violence that fits with his murders following his last deployment. It also perpetuates a cycle of violence against those of Middle Eastern ancestry. Did post-traumatic stress or traumatic brain injury play a role in these killings? Is Commander Reese on another murderous rampage, this time connected to President Christensen's administration? We will continue to update you on what is still a developing story."
"I couldn't have written that better myself," Thwaite said, clearly pleased with the anchor's performance.
"You did write it yourself, Eddie," Sawyer said, hitting the mute button on his app.
"That's right, I did,"
the senator said, now even more pleased.
"That should give the White House press corps something to pester the president and his press secretary about at Monday's briefing."
"Senator, do you even care what Reese was doing in Chicago and Atlanta, or who this team was that targeted him in Maryland?"
"Those particulars are no longer my concern. That's an FBI issue now. This is politics. We muddy the waters with this tape, and the president is forced to do his job, to live up to his responsibilities as commander-in-chief, to eradicate the virus in Richardson and Aurora before it infects and kills 90% of the country. I mean, by God, there are now reported cases in Atlanta. Atlanta! They have isolated the patients thus far, but we know it's outside the containment zones. Can you imagine if he has to bomb Atlanta?"
Sawyer remained silent and swirled the brown liquid in his glass.
"We insinuate through our contacts in established media that he bombed Texas and Colorado to divert attention away from his association with Commander Reese," Thwaite continued. "Like when President Clinton bombed Afghanistan and Sudan, when Monica's blue dress stains were the talk of the town."
"Ah, yes. Wag the dog. And what if he doesn't drop?"
"He has to drop, Eric. The country's finished if he doesn't. And I mean that literally. I don't envy him that decision, but we have an airborne virus threatening to destroy the country, possibly the world. Christensen can stop it. In fact, he's the only one who can stop it. It's political suicide, but it's his only viable decision. No one in Congress will publicly support him. They know he has to destroy two cities to save the Republic. Supporting it only takes them down with him. It simply has to be done. Only the Commander-in-Chief can make that call.
And the people of Richardson and Aurora?
It's truly heartbreaking, Eric. I don't know what else to say. Their deaths save the United States. Their deaths save the world. We will erect appropriate monuments and give speeches, sincere speeches. We will never forget their sacrifice, even though it's the only logical decision. Christensen is finished. His party will forever be known as the party that bombed America.
Yes, bombed America to save it, Sawyer pointed out.
But bombed it nonetheless. There is no recovering.
And you benefit politically from these deaths?
Saul Alinsky said it best, never let a crisis go to waste. He was right, you know.
He didn't actually say that. He was much more eloquent, Sawyer corrected.
Oh, I know. Rahm Emanuel had to dumb it down for the masses, but the point remains.
Learning from your enemy, Senator?
That's not just for you military types, Eric.
Sawyer's secure desk phone rang. Excuse me, Senator.
Can you bring me another drink while you are up?
Of course. Sawyer took a seat behind the massive oak desk and picked up the receiver. He listened intently, then said, "Stay on them," before hanging up and making the senator his drink.
Emergency? Thwaite asked, as Sawyer handed him his third martini.
As a matter of fact, yes. James Reese and Dr. Haley Garrett just landed at Dulles. Reese placed a secure call to the CIA, which we intercepted. They believe they have evidence to suggest that the virus isn't airborne.
When the senator finished his tirade and finally left the building to return to his office to call the president, Sawyer bent down to pick up the broken shards of what just moments before was a chilled martini glass. Thwaite was prone to these outbursts when things did not go his way, but this latest tantrum was worrisome. Thwaite was convinced the virus was real and spreading. All the science suggested this was true. The liberal-minded president was looking for an excuse not to do his duty. The senator believed Christensen was too weak to do what was necessary. The president was going to bring the republic down with him. He was going to destroy almost 250 years of freedom and sacrifice. James Reese was handing him the excuse he needed. For Thwaite, this was not a difficult decision. The few would be sacrificed to save the many. The country would survive. The senator's party would ascend to power once again, with Thwaite leading the way. He would take his rightful place and finally occupy the most powerful office in the land. Sawyer dropped the shards of glass in the trash and refreshed his cognac. Heading for his desk, he stopped and turned toward his bookshelf, approaching remnants of an army. He sipped his drink, examining the wounded doctor portrayed in the classic Victorian painting. Dr. Bryden was clearly in anguish. A section of his scalp had been removed by an Afghan blade in battle, his horse shot and near death. Sawyer turned to the large television. It was paused on the IR video of James Reese on the side of the Maryland Highway, rifle in hand, staring at the camera, the black and white image intensifiers giving him the look of a creature from hell. The former Army Ranger searched his book titles. There, next to a first edition of T.E. Lawrence's Revolt in the Desert, was the Peter Hopkirk classic The Great Game. Sawyer pulled it from the shelf and turned to Chapter 20. The book fell open easily at the binding, Sawyer having spent much time with it over his years of sending contractors to Central Asia. He read slowly, respectfully internalizing every word from a section titled Massacre in the Passes. Almost 100 miles of terror through snow-covered mountain passes
the army of Indus marched toward the British garrison at Jalalabad. Afghan warriors snatching souls at every turn, the savages tearing apart the 16,000 troops and camp followers as they pushed forward through freezing temperatures. Raids, sniper fire, horror. Until, a week later, one sole survivor was sighted approaching the fort, wounded on a dying horse. Sawyer looked at the television and then back at the painting. This time he saw something different. He saw himself on the horse, wounded, clinging to life, trying to make it inside the gates before being struck down. The savage Reese putting his finger to the trigger of a precision rifle, Sawyer in the crosshairs. The Navy SEAL sniper wasn't a man in this vision. He was an apparition, a black and white specter of death. He sat down at his desk and placed the great game to his left. Sawyer had been in the business of killing for most of his adult life. After Somalia, he'd learned how to profit from it. As with any enterprise, success in this business meant diversification. The lucrative U.S. military, intelligence, and diplomatic contracts might only last so long. Washington was a machine. The leadership of both political parties was fickle, all part of the same swamp apparatus, cogs in a deep state machine. In business, one had to remain on a trajectory of continual growth. Masada had expanded into worldwide mining security operations and training, advising, and assisting entities who could pay. Precious metals, conflict, diamonds, and oil all fell under the Masada profile and Sawyer's purview. On occasion, he had used certain men to solve problems. One of these men had a vested interest above and beyond money in seeing James Reese in the grave. Sawyer had used him over the past 2 years to eliminate problems in the Middle East and Africa. He was connected to the Russians and currently living in Montenegro on the Adriatic Sea. Sawyer pulled out a pen and paper and began to write a letter to enlist the services of a sniper.
Chapter 60. Russell Senate Office Building, Washington, D.C. The fear and chaos that had gripped the nation had similarly engrossed the Capitol. Rumors were spreading that the executive branch was close to bold and devastating action to contain the virus in Richardson and Aurora. A mass exodus was underway in Atlanta while some took to the streets to take advantage of the lawlessness, looting and destroying at will. Speculation, conspiracy theories, and doomsday scenarios flooded the airways and social media channels. If you were against containment and eradication, you were branded as being for the death of the nation. If you were a politician in favor of those measures, you were in the position of supporting the deaths of your own constituents. Elected representatives from Texas and Colorado were in a state of paralysis. Every answer and decision tied to the virus was rooted in death. Ambassadors from countries not yet affected by the pathogen were clamoring for information. Representatives to the United Nations gave speeches calling for the United States to act to protect the global community of nations. Throughout the turmoil, the White House remained remarkably quiet, weighing the most momentous decision ever faced by an American president. Security, press, aides, interns, staff, senators and representatives, caseworkers, legislative correspondents, schedulers, and communications directors crowded the hallways as Senator Edward Thwaite made his way to his office in the Russell Senate Office Building. Leaving his assistant holding his coat, Thwaite barged past his receptionist and into his office, slamming the door behind him. He went right for the gin, attempting to make a martini of the same class he'd downed at Sawyer's building. He ended up foregoing the bitters and lemon twist and emptied what was left of his last bottle of Bombay Sapphire in a glass with ice and a dash of dry vermouth. Unable to find any olives, he swatted a cabinet shut and took a seat in his high-backed leather chair
behind the same desk his father had used. It was up to him to save the country, save the world. He took two oversized gulps of his concoction to acquire some liquid courage before hitting the button for his receptionist.
Karen, please connect me to the White House switchboard.
It still annoyed the senator that he did not have the president's direct line or cell number.
Yes, Senator, right away.
Thwaite tapped his middle finger against his leather desk mat. After 5 minutes of tapping, he emptied his glass and began fidgeting with the cross pen he thought he'd be using to sign bills as president.
Senator?
Yes?
The operator informed me that the president is not taking calls right now.
What? In the middle of a national emergency, he's hiding in his bunker. Call back and tell the operator to put you through to the chief of staff. Wait, tell them to put you through to Greg Farber. Tell them this has national security implications that impact Richardson and Aurora, and that I have information on the reports connecting the president to Commander James Reese.
One moment, Senator.
Thwaite's eyes surveyed his dark office, taking in the artifacts of two generations in the political spotlight. Photos of history-making legislative moments. Books he hadn't read. A portrait of his father.
This could all be gone if the president doesn't take the necessary steps to save the nation. Delay means more death. Inevitably, the destruction of more cities. Richardson and Aurora, maybe even Atlanta, must be sacrificed to save the rest of us.
Senator, please hold for the president,
his receptionist said through the speaker. Thwaite straightened up in his chair, took the phone from its cradle, and cleared his throat. After 15 excruciating minutes, a voice from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue said,
Please hold for President Christensen.
A moment later, the leader of the free world's voice cracked across the line.
Senator Thwaite.
Thwaite loosened the Windsor knot at his throat and pulled the tie to the side.
Mr. President, thank you for taking my call.
Of course. We are in the middle of weighing the options regarding the virus, so forgive me if I ask you to get right to the point.
That is the purpose of my call, Mr. President. It has come to my attention that you may be delaying the inevitable and unenviable decision of eradicating the virus in Aurora and Richardson.
That is a callous way of referring to the deaths of 500,000 of our fellow countrymen, Senator.
I mean no disrespect, Mr. President,
Thwaite said, biting his tongue.
Then you will understand why I remain dedicated to protecting the nation, including those in Richardson and Aurora.
Mr. President, if I may be blunt, without the sacrifice of two cities, you are putting the rest of the nation at risk. You are signing the death warrants of millions more. This is time for decisive leadership.
May I ask where you come by your information, Senator?
This town talks, Mr. President. If you waver from doing what needs to be done, my party will have no choice but to take our case to the American people. You are neglecting your duties as Commander-in-Chief, putting the future of the nation at risk.
Rest assured, I will do what needs to be done in the interests of the American people, and I will exhaust every effort to spare those innocent lives in Aurora and Richardson,
the president responded, his tone cold and measured.
Every second you delay, the chances increase of the virus escaping containment.
Thank you for your counsel, Senator. I will take it under advisement. I was told you have information on tonight's story about Commander James Reese.
An unfortunate connection, I'm sure, Mr. President. An irresponsible news media running with only the hint of impropriety.
The president remained silent.
It would be devastating to the nation if the current emergency was compounded with a scandal. Some might say you took the drastic measures of destroying two entire cities to take focus away from your connection to a CIA assassin. The American people and your administration need to stay focused on the crisis at hand, stopping this virus.
Anything else, Senator?
Thwaite had not managed to fluster the boy president in the least.
There is something else, Mr. President. I have sources who tell me that this murderer, James Reese, is connected to your administration and has concocted a theory that the virus is not airborne. I'd hate to think the president was taking medical advice from a discredited murderer when the fate of the nation and the world hangs in the balance. These latest murders I just watched on the news seem to fit a pattern for Commander Reese. Some might call him a serial killer. It would be best for everyone if he was locked up in the Supermax prison in Florence.
Senator, I want to thank you for your call of support. Before I go, I do have a question for you.
Yes?
Have you ever looked James Reese in the eye?
Thwaite's mind drifted to the black-and-white image from the video, a specter looking straight through him.
No.